Hey guys, how's things? I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Today should be a good show. A couple of non-libertarians will be our guests. I hardly ever interview libertarians, huh? I'm still an anarchist. I just don't care about that stuff as much anymore. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin and all that. What's really bothering me is the mass killing. Oh, and the lies. The lies that go with all the mass killing. They really annoy me, too. So, I'll have people on to speak the truth for you today. Patrick Coburn will be on. And also Mitch Prothro. They could be pretty much the same damn interview, right? How's things going up there with the war in Mosul? But I think I'm going to focus more on the war with Mitch, and I'm going to focus more on France and Yemen with Patrick. I'm sure there will be some overlap. But that's all right, too. There's so many different things that we won't be able to fit in either interview. My mind's kind of racing all the things I want to ask Mitchell about the war right now. Okay, so that should be good, right? And then I'm also waiting to hear back on a couple of invites. Jason Leopold. Let's see. Chase Madar can't do it. Haven't gotten a no yet from Leopold. But waiting to hear back from him. Margulies is sick, man. I need to go ahead and... So I don't forget, I am beginning my get well email to Eric right now. Let's hope it's nothing serious. But otherwise, man, I can't wait to talk to Eric Margulies again. A terrorist attack in France? Why, that's the perfect subject matter for Eric Margulies to talk about. Expert that he is in all things France and all things Islam and all things terrorism and all things all kinds of things. But maybe we'll have that for you. I don't know. Possibly for the Sunday KPFK show, or you might have to wait till next week. But I promise I'll get Eric on as soon as I can again. All right. And then otherwise, I don't know. I guess I got a ton of news to cover for you here. I don't want to get too far into the France thing since there's going to be an interview along those lines in just a little while. But I want to touch on one point that's being made actually as we speak again right now on Fox News. White House defends refusal to describe Paris attack as a work of radical Islam. They say it is not accurate to say that this was an attack by radical Islam. And so now, Obama didn't go to stand in the photo opportunity. This is the new political talking point. Can you imagine how sad it must be to be a Republican or a Democrat who really gets caught up in just what's the latest talking point? You know, I am just so outraged that Barack Obama did not go over there and stand in the photo opportunity because, you know, Sean Hannity said that that was important to me and derp, derp, to derp. My God, I would shoot myself in the head. But anyway, I think that this is a great one for them to pick a fight about because of how wrong they are. And because this is one thing that Obama has done correctly this week. He slaughters people all damn day. But in this case, at least he's characterizing the situation accurately. No one is even arguing, are they really? That the two brothers and their buddy, that they all just got as pious as could be in the last few weeks. And boy, as soon as they got extreme in their Islamic belief, once they believed in Islam so much all of a sudden, they decided that they hated all good things and had to attack them. No one's saying that. And these two brothers, I don't know so much about their friend, but these two brothers are a known quantity to French cops, French journalists, and even, as I told you on the show the other day, I read an article where they're quoting the sociologists from down at the local college who had studied the wannabe jihadi goofballs who hang around in the park all day and had written a paper about them. And they were wannabe jihadis, but they weren't the most devout. That wasn't what characterized them. They were political. The one guy, he wanted to be a rapper. He smoked weed. You know, like Muhammad Atta, I'm sure he spent plenty of time at the nudie bar. Because it's not about Islam. It's not about an extreme amount of belief in Islam. It's not. And I'm glad that Fox News idiots have picked this to be their talking point. Possibly we could have a real fight about this. And, you know, I don't know. It's not like the Democrats are going to actually explain the real truth about what's going on here. They hate us, quote unquote, because our government murders them and has unendingly, directly since 1991, but indirectly since long before that. And so... You know, that's the problem. The Democrats are never going to say that. What they're going to say is, well, it's not regular old Islam that does this. It's this very particular kind of weirdo sort of warped, twisted, false, heretical belief in Islam. Well, that's not for outsiders to say. You're only going to, first of all, reinforce the people who are buying it when you have a bunch of, you know, non-believers from across the ocean saying what's heresy and what's not heresy. That's got to be an internal matter, which, by the way, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State are both losing that as far as the consensus of Sunni imams in the world about what's legitimate and what's not. But meanwhile, is it any surprise that the people who, like bin Laden and his closest associates, like Ayman al-Zawahiri and them, who have these kind of Saudi... based Takfiri, Salafi belief system, very intolerant, that they would be the first ones to fight in a defensive war where every government is controlled by the enemy. Every local government is controlled by the enemy. So they have no army to volunteer for. All they can do is join up, you know, these stateless pirate type groups like Al-Qaeda. But is it any surprise that those who are the most committed to their religion would also be the most committed to a self-sustaining war against a foreign power on the part of private actors? No. It's just the same as if it was Red Dawn and the North Koreans came and took over America, like Hollywood would have you believe could possibly happen in 10 zillion years. Then it would be the Pat Robertson brigades would be the first ones to pull out their rifles and start shooting the invading commies, right? What do you think? It's going to be a bunch of hippies and secularists and moderates are going to go and fight? No. Look who goes and joins up the army to go and fight these guys in this current war right now, and that's with an army to go join. It tends to be people who are poorer and more religious. Because it's, you know, once you're already in the process of having faith and believing what you're told and conflating this thing, that thing, and the other thing all together, then hey, what could, as our guest explained on the show the other day, or I guess I kind of quoted his own article back at him, that, he's going to fight for his own people, for God and for country, for America, for freedom, all these things he believes. It's the same kind of shtick on the other side. In fact, go look at Justin Raimondo's article. He's got a link to the statement of the terrorist at the grocery store explaining why he did what he did. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back to the show, okay? I'm Scott. It's my show. All right? Hey, listen, this is not a justification. Don't think for a moment that it's a justification, even if you're a conservative. Really? Well, it is a justification, but not by me. It's a self-justification by a murderer who murdered innocent people in cold blood. At least five of them, right? He murdered an unarmed police woman. And then I think, if I have it right, he murdered four people at this grocery store. This is a murderer. Justifying himself, okay? Now, to me, it's a reason, and I think it's important that you understand it. It doesn't mean that I'm saying it's okay. Okay, so any sixth graders or conservatives in the audience there, I hope that you can understand that. I tried to say it in simple English six different ways so that you could. But here is the murderer justifying himself. I was born in France. If they didn't attack other countries, I wouldn't be here. This is Koulibaly, whatever, the terrorist, justifying himself to his hostages. There's an open telephone to a radio station recording the whole thing. And he's rationalizing to his hostages why he is doing this to them. Right? This isn't just a video he made for the internet. This is him to his own hostages. I was born in France, he says. If they didn't attack other countries, I wouldn't be here. In RTL, that's the radio station, in their recording, the man purported to be Koulibaly. Sorry, I guess I should have figured out how to say that before I started talking about it. Tells the hostages that they are accountable for France's actions against Muslim militants abroad and whoever else they murder. In part because the hostages pay taxes and elect the government's leaders. Quote, but I am telling you, it's almost over. Militants are going to come. There are going to be more and more. France needs to stop. They need to stop attacking ISIS. They need to stop asking our women to remove their hijab. You pay taxes, so that means you agree with France's actions in Mali. And in the Middle East, the apparent gunman says in the recording. But we have to pay the taxes, one of his hostages says. The response from the apparent gunman appears incredulous. What? We don't have to. I don't pay my taxes. And the hostage says, when I pay my taxes, it's for the highways, the schools, an apparent hostage says. We pay our taxes, but we don't harm anybody, says another hostage. They are, in fact, held hostage by their state. It's the only way you can have a road or a school is through them, and they make you pay or they'll put you in jail. And if you resist, they'll kill you. That's what a tax is. If it wasn't all that, it'd be called a price. So, of course, they're right. Just because they pay taxes doesn't mean that they're endorsing anything the government does or that they're responsible for what their government does. We pay our taxes. We don't harm anybody, another innocent hostage says. The man purported to be Koulibaly says. Everyone could get together. If they could get together for Charlie Hebdo, they could do the same thing for us and get together for us, he says. And then Raimondo's got it perfect. Horrible, pathetic, and heartbreaking all at once. They could do the same thing for us and get together for us. So, there is the mind of a terrorist hostage murderer. The French government kills Muslims in Iraq and Syria. and in Africa. They oppress Muslims in France, and so he's joined up the war on the other side. America especially, but France too, has been delivering September 11ths to these people for years on end now. And he's saying, if that's the way it is, then this is the role I will play in the thing. Nowhere does he say, Muhammad made me do it. Nowhere does he say, you French, with your pornography and your movies and your miniskirts and your cartoon characters. Nowhere does he say, how dare you have a democracy? How dare you have what's left of your free speech rights in this country? He doesn't say that. He's on a mission. He's part of a terrorist mission to provoke a reaction over actual political facts in reality. Just as Matthew Alexander explained on the show last week, he interrogated thousands of foreign fighters who traveled to Iraq to fight, and none of them ever said they did it because of their Islam. And, you know, he was interrogating the hell out of them. I guess you could try to spin it like, oh, gee, I guess he just didn't know what question to ask, but he's the guy who got Zarqawi. So he must know a little something about something. And what they all said was, we're here fighting in solidarity with our fellow human beings against the foreign occupier, aggressor, oppressor. And now, again, this isn't a rationalization from me. I'm citing the rationalization of the perpetrator. Okay? I'm citing his excuse. To me, reason. To him, excuse. Of course it's not good enough. Of course it's not taking his side. He has the ethics of a Democrat. That it's okay to kill innocent people in revenge for what someone else did. That's horrible. I'm not justifying it. I'm just begging you, I guess, to understand. Because when people say they do it because they hate freedom, they're lying to you. Because they want to be able to continue to get away with doing the wrong thing. That is the real cause of our terrorist problem, and that is intervention in the Middle East. And I'm referring to the people with power. I know your uncle or brother-in-law who thinks this is just a damned fool who believes what he's told by liars, but so he's kind of a de facto pseudo-liar, but he means well. But I'm talking about the people with power who know better. You know, the fact that Every speech violating potentate in the region and in Europe and everywhere else felt free to line up and lock arms with Benjamin Netanyahu, the journalist slayer, in order to defend free speech here, as Arthur Silber says, is proof right there that nothing happening here is in defiance of the state. Nothing here is about protecting free speech from the state. It's only about protecting the prerogatives of people who side with the state to help them demonize their enemies. And that's a great article by Arthur Silber that's running on antiwar.com today. And by the way, the French police arrested a comedian this morning for a post on Facebook. That's how much they love free speech over there. Oh, see, he wasn't attacking Muslims was his problem. See how that works?
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. First up today is the heroic Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. And, of course, he's also the author of Muqtada and the latest book, The Jihadi's Return. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you?
Hi, Scott.
Very happy to have you back on the show here. Very happy that you're writing, and very happy to have the opportunity to run your articles where people can see them. First of all, could we please talk about this piece, Paris Attacks, Don't Blame These Atrocities on Security Failures. First of all, just on the headline there, seems like the security failures were pretty bad if everybody knew for years and years, for 10 years, these two brothers' sympathies with the Zarqawiites, right?
No, I don't think so, because, I mean, when people like that actually do something, it jumps out at you from the page if you're reading it, or the screen if you're watching it. You know, there are thousands, tens of thousands of people like that in Europe. They can't all be arrested. I think the problem is rather different, and hence the headline, which is, you know, there are now six, maybe seven wars raging from the Pakistan border to Tunisia, and from Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and northeast Nigeria. And each of these wars are really civil wars in which Al-Qaeda type organizations are either very powerful, as in Iraq or Syria, or fairly powerful, as in Yemen, or a growing strength in Libya and Mali and northeast Nigeria. So people from Europe can, jihadis from Europe can expect sanctuary there, they can expect sympathy there, or maybe they just want to emulate what they're doing. So when you have six or seven states in a state of civil war, where European jihadis from France or Britain or wherever can seek refuge, then it's pretty well impossible to eliminate them or stop them all coming backwards and forwards. Mm. I mean, what it's really like, Scott, I think, is, you know, what I'd compare these countries to, it's like, you know, if we had six malarial swamps on our doorstep, and with malarial mosquitoes buzzing around, you know, we could stop some of those mosquitoes coming into our house, we could swat others and eliminate them, but we won't be able to eliminate them all. You know, there's going to be a consequence in Europe, mm-hmm. of this tremendous violence throughout the region, which has engulfed so many countries.
Yeah, I think it'd be unfair to omit the fact that you warned us. I mean, you and I have been talking about this on this show for quite a few years in a row now, that, well, let me put it in the form of a question to you. Obama, never mind the original sin of the Iraq invasion, which just turned the whole region upside down. Obama came in to end all this, and he seemed to be kind of trying, in the sense where when he talked about ISIS as junior varsity, what he was trying to do, he was even saying he wanted to repeal the authorization to use military force. And he was saying, let's not buy into the trap that every time an angry Sunni has a rifle and calls himself Al-Qaeda somewhere, that we have to go running, right? Like, he's wising up to how this strategy on the part of our enemies works, and he doesn't want to fall for it anymore. But then, so my question is, if he had just gotten out of Iraq and winded it all down, instead of escalating in Afghanistan and Pakistan, instead of escalating in Yemen and Somalia, and instead of fighting outright on the side of the jihadis in Libya and Syria, might that strategy have actually worked, even post 8 years of Bush? Might Obama have been able to ramp this whole thing down? How much of this is actually his legacy rather than Bush's, is sort of what I'm getting at, if you understand.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I'm not sure there's a definitive answer. I think that Obama, but also the Europeans, the West Europeans, France, Britain, and the Arab monarchies, Saudi Arabia, and the Sunni monarchies, the Gulf, all got it wrong in a sense. They, well, let's say maybe the monarchies didn't, that they, in Syria, backing the opposition meant that it was a way of getting rid of Assad, And Washington and the Europeans thought that he'd go down just like Gaddafi went down in Libya. It never happened. It simply spread anarchy. And by 2012, Islamic State and the Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate, were taking advantage of this and have gradually become the dominant forces in the rebel-held parts of Syria. And these, of course, are now open to European jihadis. I think this was a big mistake by Obama. Libya also, not just Obama, but Sarkozy of France and Cameron Britain, all backed NATO in supporting the rebels in Libya. But in fact, I mean, I covered that war. The rebels wouldn't have lasted long without NATO support. They were really a mopping up force. It was really a NATO victory over Gaddafi. And look at the state of Libya now. You know, it's been reduced to rule by militias, fighting for money, fighting for oil, continual assassinations throughout the country. The country is really broken up. Again, this is very fertile soil for al-Qaeda organizations. They've taken over a whole city down there in eastern Libya. So I think that these were tremendous mistakes made by Obama and the Europeans. Now, maybe the Saudis and others quite wanted to, quite liked the idea of Sunni fundamentalists taking over some of these countries, or did at the time. But certainly this was a big mistake by the Western powers.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that this isn't exactly your specialty, but you must have some kind of idea of whether, if Obama had told the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks that, no, I know you want your pipeline, and no, I know you hate Assad, but no, you may not back the rebellion in Syria because these are the bin Ladenites who knocked down our towers, and we are not going to have it, and so you better back off. Would they have backed off, or they would have told Uncle Sam, forget you, we can do whatever we want?
I think it was a bit late in the day. You know, I think the pass was sold, you know, under the Bush administration after 9/11, when, you know, as we've often discussed and is well known, that 15 out of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, that U.S. inquiries found that the money came from private Saudi donors, that bin Laden himself, of course, came from the Saudi elite. By backing off Saudi Arabia as a source, I don't mean the government, I mean the of Saudi Arabia, but I mean people within Saudi Arabia were the source of 9/11. And at the same time, backing off a confrontation with Pakistan that was really crucial to the creation of the Taliban, the Bush administration created a situation in which Al-Qaeda was never eliminated and always had the potential to grow. And look at the situation now. You know, we have these vast resources put by the U.S. and the Western powers into their security agencies. They've gone in for rendition and torture and mistreatment. You know, they've limited civil liberties. But 9/11, you know, Al-Qaeda was not a big organization. It was in, you know, a part of Afghanistan and a part of Pakistan. And now it's an enormous organization. So if a war ever failed, the war on terror certainly did.
All right. Well, we got to hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with the greatest journalist in the world, Patrick Coburn. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Okay, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Patrick Coburn all about the France attack and the blowback and et cetera. And by the way, Patrick, I have to say, I mean, it sure seems like everybody and their dog in France knew who these guys were, including the sociologist down at the local college and and hands full of journalists and everything else. He's on the no-fly list and all this. So it doesn't seem like too much mystery about who these guys are. But then again, some of this stuff sounds a little too perfect. Well, they went to Syria and they went to Yemen. And by the way, it was Anwar al-Awlaki, that the American citizen that Obama murdered him and his son, who financed his trip to Yemen, too. And it all sounds maybe a little bit too perfect. I wonder whether all that just sounds right to you. Do you have your own intelligence sources who you trust who are confirming this or that aspect of just who these guys were who did this attack and why?
No, I think it's kind of what it looks like. But I mean, one point I would make is, you know, there's quite a, the media has made quite a meal of suggesting these guys were trained, you know. Maybe they got a little bit of training in Yemen, you know, on how to use a gun, which, you know, how to pull a trigger. But, you know, bear in mind, you know, it doesn't require much training to murder a bunch of cartoonists or a couple of Alex, you know, policemen who don't expect anybody to shoot at them. It doesn't, take, training, you know, to murder, four people in a shop. So, you know, somehow this, I think it comes from the movies, you know, this idea of the highly trained assassins, you know, from abroad, that's a stereotype from the movies. Mm-hmm. But these guys, you know, they, I don't know if it's confirmed, they, one of them left his ID in the card that they'd stolen, you know, so it's pretty easy to identify him that way. You know, they didn't even know where the Charlie Hebdo office was. They had to ask people. Yet today you have some Al-Qaeda, person in Yemen. Say, yeah, we organized all this. You know, they organized it. They couldn't even look up where the address of the target was, you know. So I take all this with a big pinch of salt, you know, these guys. You know, it's one of the lethal aspects of these Al-Qaeda type operations that they're, targeting very, soft targets, mm-hmm. That have no way of defending themselves. And it doesn't require much organization. Mm-hmm. It requires a couple of guns in this case, maybe some money, although they robbed a gas station, so maybe they didn't have any. I think all that's exaggerated.
Yeah, now, I mean, I don't think there's any way to argue other than we've been in the entire West extremely lucky at how little blowback we've suffered from these interventions when it is that easy for someone to just take a rifle and go to a ball game or any kind of place where there's a crowd of people. Whatever it is. I mean, it's easy. Hijack a gasoline truck and crash it into something at full speed or, you know, anything easy like that, that any one person could do by themselves, accomplish with a handgun or a knife. So that just goes to show.
To get killed. I mean, you know, what's the really potent part of this is people who are prepared to get killed. And all three of the murderers in this case in Paris seem to, while they didn't, well, they weren't like suicide bombers, but they didn't have made any elaborate plans to escape, and they seem to have expected to die. So, I mean, that's what makes them lethal, is the willingness to get killed themselves. And it's very difficult, obviously, to combat that. I think that in Paris, you know, one of the, we've yet to see what the real fallout is. Will the French overreact? To the degree that they further marginalize or alienate people in this 5 million strong Muslim community in France, mostly Algerians, often living in slum housing projects around the cities. You know, it wouldn't take much to do this. How careful are they? Because the way all these Al-Qaeda type operations really work, and I'm not saying that the immediate perpetrators may know this, but the effect only, their success only becomes apparent later when we can see if the victims or the country from which the victims come grossly overreacts, as happened after 9/11, and actually fall into a trap, do exactly what Al-Qaeda wants them to do, which is what Bush and, the others did by invading Iraq and eventually sending troops to Afghanistan, that this was very much what Al-Qaeda and bin Laden wanted and had said so. So But it's tempting to governments, because all governments want to walk tall. They want to show they're in charge. They talk about waging war and so forth. It's a very tempting trap for governments.
Right. Now, so to that point, you know, I know, well, they say anyway that Baghdadi walks around with a suicide belt on and all this, implying that he doesn't care. He's ready to die. He's happy to die tomorrow if it comes to that. He's not a typical politician out for himself in that kind of way, a true believer and happy to see this war play out over, you know, decades after he's gone, I guess, is really kind of the message there. But so then I wonder, does that mean, do you think they really want a full-scale George W. Bush-sized invasion, even if that means a short-term or medium-term end of the Islamic State, just so that America would be that much more bankrupt and they could be that much more victorious later on somehow?
It's difficult. I simply don't know, because the Islamic State's policy is a peculiar mixture of careful calculation and sort of feckless violence. They're pretty astute in the first half of last year, the first three quarters of last year, in the way they prepared and concealed their attack on Mosul. Then they attacked into us, expanded in Syria. So their military strategy was pretty effective, I think even more effective than they imagined. But then from August on, they attack the Kurds in both Iraq and Syria. That eventually brings in American airstrikes. Did they want this, that they would be the chief opponent of America? It's possible, but it's also, I think, you're dealing with a very crazy organization which believes it's divinely inspired. And it may just take on enemies because they think that with God's help, they're always going to win. So there's that sort of manic element to it.
Yeah. Well, and now, I spoke with Reese Ehrlich the other day, and he had just gotten back from Kurdistan. And I was asking him, just how dangerous is this organization? Because some say, come on, ISIS, they're just another militia, and they got nothing. And then, obviously, you take them much more seriously than that. But so Ehrlich was saying, well, he thinks they're an extreme danger and they're very powerful, but only in the short term. And that over the medium or the long term, they're guaranteed to burn themselves out, to self-destruct, to make themselves completely unwelcome where they attempt to rule. And so therefore, we could really take as much of a hands-off approach as possible. And that would be the best way to get rid of them, would be to just let them burn themselves out and make enemies of all those they would try to rule. What do you think of that?
A lot of people have argued that, but, you know, hold on a minute. They make themselves real unpopular with a lot of people in Mosul and the areas they've taken, about 5 or 6 million people probably living there in Iraq and Syria. But, you know, the people they make themselves unpopular with, there's not much they can do about it because these are very dangerous, very violent people, you know. I've talked to people from Mosul, who really don't like the Islamic State. They think it's a disaster, but their response to this is to try and escape from Mosul and move to Kurdish territory or to move to Turkey or Baghdad. Not easy to do, by the way, because if you have a house there in Mosul or the Islamic State think that you've left and have permanently fled their area, they give you 10 days to come back. Otherwise, they confiscate your house without compensation. Now, that sort of prevents a lot of people moving and has got some of them moving back. So these are quite astute people. So I don't think that they'll necessarily implode because they've got a structure. They've got their own mukhabarat, security forces. They've got their recruiting. They're conscripting more soldiers. They're fighting on multiple fronts in Iraq and Syria. That shows how many guys they've got. So I don't think that's necessarily going to happen at all. In Syria, the Syrian government and this army is kind of fought out. So if there was a really big Islamic State offensive against the Syrian army, you know, would it hold out? It's not entirely clear where that would happen.
Yeah.
What would the U.S. then do? Would it stand back and let the Islamic State hammer the Syrian army and become the dominant power in Syria? Or would it act, alongside the Syrian army, it's had with the Syrian Kurds? That's an important political decision that Obama hasn't taken.
Right. Yeah, that was what Hegel said when he resigned was, the confusion over the Syria policy. There is no Syria policy that he could even comprehend, and that was what the fight was about, apparently. So they're just going to kick that can down the road, I guess. But anyway, we're out of time. But thank you so much for your time, Patrick. Great one again.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. That's Patrick Coburn from The Independent, author of The Jihadi's Return. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. All right, coming up, Mitch Prothero with his take on the current state of the war. I think that interview I'm going to try to keep more narrowly focused on what's happening in Baghdad, what's happening in Fallujah, what's happening with the helicopters and the spies and the dam and the fight against the Islamic State there. Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers coming up. So now listen, Iran sanctions. Now, Paul Pillar, I have to give this disclaimer about Paul Pillar every time I talk about him. I guess I should just get him on the show and go ahead and have it out with him. I don't know. The problem is, he writes some pretty good stuff. But also the problem is he lied us into war with Iraq, and his signature is on the damn thing. The CIA, et cetera, the National Intelligence Council came together and wrote the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq in 2002, said they had a bunch of chemical weapons and that they were working on nukes, or they would like to acquire to begin to study the blah, 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 something nuclear and a bunch of crap. And Paul Pillar's signature is on there. And as far as I can tell, and I have Googled it a little bit, I don't think he ever said he was sorry. I think he's doing a pretty good job of making up for it by trying to write more clear-headed things now. He's no libertarian, but he's certainly no neocon. Writes for the national interest, and we run him at antiwar.com. But I just can't help, I can't talk about him without talking about the fact that, hey, no, really, seriously, he could have stopped that war single-handedly. Or he could have at least made a heroic effort. All those of us who were trying to stop the war and just didn't know how. What can we do? How can we stop it? What can we do? Paul Pillar could have stopped it. Paul Pillar could have gotten on the news hour and said, listen, the intelligence is bogus. How do I know? Because I'm on the National Intelligence Council. And he didn't do it. And anyway, I have to say that. That's my disclaimer for bringing up Paul Pillar. Before I talk about Paul Pillar wrote a good thing. Paul Pillar wrote a good thing. It's on antiwar.com, and it's about how the damned Republicans especially, but also the damned Democrats, are going to pass new Iran sanctions. And the sanctions are going to say, basically, you have to do everything and according to the deal, if we strike a deal, if you strike a deal with Obama, if you so much as blink or sneeze or look at us funny, then these sanctions will go into effect. And how the Congress is saying, the Lindsey Grahams of the world are saying, well, see, this is just a great way to make sure that the Iranians stay within the deal. They lie and pretend that 10 years ago doesn't exist, and we don't need to know anything about 10 years ago. And all we need to know is their slogan, the sanctions brought them to the table. So the threat of more and more and more can only help to make them do what we want them to do. But Paul Pillar says, okay, fine. Except put your shoe on the other foot for just a second. What if the Iranian Mujis, or whatever the hell, they have their different councils of religious congresses and houses of lords and whatever crap in their pseudo-democracy over there. And what if their Senate passed some sanctions that said, or not sanctions, that's too much on the other foot. What if they just said, for their part of the deal, if the Americans don't live up to every part of their part of the deal in terms of lifting these sanctions and those restrictions and trade and whatever, then we will immediately reopen Fordo and start enriching up to 20%. We will immediately start construction on a facility to separate plutonium away from the waste left over from the Iraq reactor, and we're going to stop reconfiguring that reactor so that it will only produce very polluted plutonium, etc. What if they started going back on their end of the deal, or if they passed a law promising to the moment the Americans did anything at all wrong? I'm sorry it took me so damn long to explain that, but I think you understand what I mean. And of course, the answer is the Republicans especially, but even in the presidency, they would be completely freaking out. How dare those dastardly Iranian, Persian, you know, whatever insult things, untrustworthy, crazy 12th Imamers, how dare they pass a bill that says that they're prepared to go back on their end of the deal at a moment's notice? But that's what we're doing. And how is that supposed to help the negotiations? Well, good question. Is it meant to help the negotiations or hurt them? So there are two answers there. There's some people who think that, hey, this is a great way to sabotage the negotiations. And there are other people who believe those people's lies. Yeah, that's a good way to make sure the negotiations succeed. So that's who I'm addressing, and that's who Paul Pilar is addressing here. Is, you know, don't take for granted that John Bolton and Lindsey Graham mean what they say. We know what they want. We know what their motives are. Keep your eye on the ball when it comes to that. But for people who agree with them that this is the best way to help Obama get the deal signed, Obama and Kerry get the actual nuclear deal signed, then no, I think you can see the quite reasonable objection. And if the Iranians threatened to go back on their end of the deal at a moment's notice, it would do everything to harm the politics on this side and make it that much more difficult to get the deal struck in the first place, which I think we can agree is the reason that Lindsey Graham is pushing this. And, you know, he just told, and I'm sorry I didn't get Scott McConnell on. He couldn't do it, but please go read Scott McConnell's latest piece at the American Conservative magazine, where, man, I can't remember what it was anymore, but he had the greatest quote from Lindsey Graham about following. You might have heard this. It was following Netanyahu's lead. We're going to follow your lead. Not just we have your back, but we're going to follow your lead, Prime Minister, on what our Iran sanctions policy should be in the U.S. Congress. But there was more to it than that, and I don't remember the rest of the quote, but I remember thinking, my God, man. But so go look at that. It's at the American Conservative magazine. You can pull it up your dang self. But so there you go. And Netanyahu, of course, doesn't want a deal because he wants a regime change. And if we get a nuclear deal, even though they're not making nuclear weapons, and the Ayatollah has forbidden it and says that it's haram, it's forbidden by Islam to have weapons of mass destruction. Even the meaner, older, at war at the time Ayatollah said so in the 1980s. And America got rid of Saddam Hussein for them, so they have no need for any weapons of mass destruction at all. They couldn't deliver any to Israel if they tried, so it wouldn't even be a deterrent to Israel if they had one. So anyway, the point is, it's a big, fake red herring of an issue, which is why it ought to be easy to put to bed. All they want is a civilian nuclear program. Let them have their damn civilian nuclear program. Make them jump through whatever hoops and sign whatever additional protocols to so that the IAEA can continue to verify their non-diversion of declared nuclear material to any military or other special purpose, and then we can all get on with our lives. Then we can begin to possibly have a rapprochement with Iran. We don't have to be best friends, but we could have a China-type relationship with them, right? We don't have to be allies, but we could be trading partners and we can be associates. And it is just one planet Earth we live on together with them, all of us stranded here on this giant spaceship as we are with them. So, hey, maybe we can figure out a way to work it out. Figure out a way to, you know, like Dick Cheney called for in 1998. A repeal of the sanctions so that Halliburton can do business. You know, they're not really an oil company. They're an oil services company, which means they build military bases. But it also means they build pipelines and infrastructure and refineries and they sell the equipment for digging new wells and this kind of thing. That's good business for Texas. And in fact, as much as the Saudis are and the Americans governments are screwing Houston in order to screw Iran and to screw Russia right now, continuing to overproduce in a giant glut, when usually what they do is try to keep the prices artificially high in order to try to punish Russia and Iran, Houston ought to get on board for this thing and say, hey, let's have peace with Iran. Screw the Saudis. I mean, it depends. Houston ain't Houston, right? There's a few different companies there, and they got different relationships with different people at different times to different extents. You know, the Kochs, they mostly do their business down in Venezuela. I think it's more Exxon concerned with Iraq, and I don't know who all wants in on Iran. BP. I know they've got a refinery there. Oh, well. Cops news next. Oh, and Ukraine and Georgia stuff. Got to talk about that.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. So today the deputy some crap of NATO. Hang on, let me look on my damn Twitter thing here. Who is this idiot? Where the hell did it go? Oh, here, Alexander Virchow. And Alexander Virchow is the NATO deputy secretary general. Previously U.S. ambassador to NATO, Russia, and South Korea, and assistant secretary of defense. Jeez, seems like I should already know who this guy is so I could hate him better. What a horrible person he must be. God dang. And then he tweets out, NATO is fully committed to Georgia's future membership. All tools are in place to move forward. All tools are in place to move forward with Georgia's aspirations. Holy crap. Oh, and another. NATO and aspiring member Georgia have robust partnership with high degree of interoperability of forces thanks to the mission in Afghanistan. Oh, my God. So, there you go. The whole thing, NATO expansion, ultimately is a gigantic Lockheed project to expand interoperability, you know, because Georgia is such a powerful ally for America to have lined up to help defend us in case we get into trouble, right? Yeah. No, and I'm not talking about the Georgia where Matthew, the computer genius, lives over there, the one with the fancy airport we've all been through so many times. No, I mean the one that you very well may not know where it is on a map. You may have no idea. Right there between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. Do you know where those seas are? I'm addressing Americans here. I know there are internationals in the audience. Anyway, down there in the southern Caucasus Mountains, it's what used to be referred to more often, I guess, as former Soviet Georgia, land birthplace of Joseph Stalin. And anyway, it's, how do you say, biting off more than you can chew. That's what it is. And you might remember that in August of 2008, the then president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, attacked a breakaway province called South Ossetia, which had Russian peacekeepers occupying it under an agreement with the European Union that the Americans also blessed, as though that's where legitimacy comes from. But anyway, just for footnote's sake. And they killed a bunch of Russians in their attack on South Ossetia. And so the Russians fought back. And guess who won? Yeah, the Russians. And then get this, according to journalist Ron Suskin, and in fact, this was followed up and verified by another source, although I can't remember which journalist it was anymore. Maybe chat room guys can help me if you know, I don't know. But Ron Suskin reported, man, I know this. It may have even been somebody on my show said something about this. Right, guys? Do you remember? ScottHorton.org/chat if you remember, or tweet me. But anyway, I know Suskin said, I haven't even gotten to the point yet, you're waiting for me to tell you what it is. Suskin said that Dick Cheney was pushing for strikes on the Russians coming through the Caucasus Mountains. There's tunnels under the Caucasus Mountains. And Cheney was pushing for strikes, and Stephen Hadley was rolling his eyes, and I guess the way the anecdote goes, Bush said, all right, anybody else agree with the vice president? Okay, next order of business then. No, we're not going to attack the Russians when it was our guy started it. And there's a great lesson in media there, too, where all over the world, everybody knew what had happened. Just like with the Ukraine coup. Everybody knows exactly what happened all over the world. But in American media, in the New York Times, oh, Russian aggression. Russia attacked poor little Georgia. With no mention of the fact that it was the Georgian government that moved first. And they just blacked that out. It wasn't until the end of November 2008. After Obama and McCain and Tom Brokaw had all agreed to lie about it in their debate with each other, too, which was funny. You could see them all kind of sending body language signals to each other that we're all going with the lie on this, that Russia started it, right? Right? Oh, okay, good. Nobody's going to bring up what actually happened? Oh, okay, good. Thanks. And then it wasn't until the end of November that the New York Times ran a story called, yeah, the guys at antiwar.com who called us dirty, filthy, stinking, warmongering liars were right. That was actually the headline in the New York Times. Antiwar.com is right, and we are dirty, filthy, stinking liars. And that, geez, all anyone had to do was just go read it in the Telegraph, or the Guardian, or the Independent, or Der Spiegel, or what do they call the paper in Rome there? I'm sure they have a paper in Rome. All you had to do was read any source that was being published outside of those who have a contract to reprint New York Times articles. And you'd have known the truth, but they finally admitted it months later. Great little study in media deception. Anyway, so now they're on track. Bush had put them off, but and they've been kind of on slow motion on track. Now they're on track for bringing Georgia and then later, I guess, Ukraine into NATO. Which Yatsenyuk, the sock puppet America-installed prime minister of Ukraine, is still talking about himself. And so now you can see how John Mearsheim was absolutely right when he wrote in Foreign Affairs that this is America's fault. It's America's fault. You can see that Robert Perry and Ray McGovern are just 100% on point at consortiumnews.com about how this is America's thing here. They used a bunch of Nazis, real, no-fooling, Hitler-loving Nazis, the sons and grandsons of those who literally served Hitler in the Holocaust, to overthrow the democratically elected government in Kiev and install their sock puppet regime, which then declared war against those who would resist them in the East. While all American media goes on and on endlessly about Russian aggression and Russian aggression with just no mention whatsoever. It's like saying, yeah, Pearl Harbor, without ever mentioning the steel embargo, the oil embargo. Yeah, you think that might have anything to do with Pearl Harbor at all? Not a justification, but the beginning of an explanation about maybe what was really going on there. Oh, no, you know what happened was those Japanese, those filthy Japs with their circular glasses and their buck teeth, they sneakily sneaked to attack us because of their Shinto extremism. That's what it was. Once you believe in Shintoism extremely, then it makes you want to die in suicide attacks against things that are good and beautiful and wonderful and free. See how that works? Doesn't that sound like the most plausible explanation to you, too? Yeah, anyway. So, it's been brought up in the show many times. It's been brought up in many essays. It was brought up this morning on Twitter. Someone replied back to my retweet here. Yeah, of course, because just like if Russia had invited Mexico into the Warsaw Pact, the USA wouldn't care about that at all. In fact, a better example would be if they took Alaska and Hawaii. You know? Or maybe Texas. But anyway, so just put yourself in the Russians' shoes for one moment and you can see who's the aggressor. It's America, the evil empire. And that doesn't make Putin a good person or a single government employee in Russia a good person in any way. It just means that our side started it. And they're liars.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to The Thing here. I'm Scott Horton, and it's the show. The Scott Horton Show. Hey, next up, it's our friend Mitchell Prothero, special correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, reporting out of Erbil, Kurdistan. Welcome back to the show, Mitch. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm just trying to see if we have a D.
To see if we got
how
a
what? Coming through? How am I coming through? Are you able to hear me on the connection?
You sound good now.
Okay, cool.
It was a little sketchy at first, yeah, but you sound okay now.
I had to move a router around, you know, technical issues all the time. I'm sure you guys have them.
Yep, it happens. Yeah. Live radio, no problem, and you sound okay now. So,
okay, well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, I'm very happy to have you back on the show. So let's talk about the situation up there in Kurdistan. Please remind me the name of the towns between Erbil and Mosul and what all happened, and then explain what all happened with this battle, last week now?
Well, it's been an ongoing situation. There's two strategic towns that sort of control the approaches to Erbil from Mosul. You're talking about a pretty small area. I think Mosul's about 30, 40 miles away max from Erbil. And these are towns stuck in the middle between the two that have basically turned into front lines. They're called Gwer and Mahmur. Both of these towns were taken over by the Islamic State in August. They were quickly retaken with the help of U.S. airstrikes. But it sort of turned into a static front line that on Saturday, the Islamic State pulled a little maneuver where they used basically the fog of a heavy winter storm to smuggle a couple hundred guys across a river in, from what I can tell from my CENTCOM press release, 21 boats because they were later blown up by airstrikes. And they sort of took the Kurds by surprise from behind. There was a pretty nasty battle that raged for about a day. The Kurds lost about 30 guys in 2 days, which is probably the most in a single fight since August. And now it's sort of solidified again around a front line where the Kurds are blasting the heck out of them with heavy artillery and new German anti-tank weapons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a very important part of the story that you have there is the Kurds, I guess you quote a Kurdish commander saying, well, thank God, at least we got some weapons now because the Americans, the Germans, and the Russians have come through for them. Is that it?
Well, basically, yeah. I mean, I don't know that the Russians have actually sent aid, but a lot of the equipment used in Iraq by everybody is of Soviet origin. So, you know, ammunition.
Oh, just left over from Saddam days.
Right. I mean, the AK-47 or its variant is, you know, ubiquitous to every battlefield on Earth, it feels like. So they were able to get a lot of ammunition for those sorts of weapons. I think the Brits helped transport a bunch from Czechoslovakia and Ukraine, maybe. There were some factories that were producing, you know, AK ammo, RPGs, things like that. But the primary stuff that's really helped out for them has been heavier weapons that primarily have been supplied by the Germans. The Americans are a little reluctant to go around to Baghdad. It's a complex situation, but essentially, because the Kurds are not an independent nation, it's harder to transfer them weapons without them first going through the Iraqi government, which promptly steals them. So the Kurds have always been sort of neglected by what we call a rule, you know, designed to prevent illegal arms trafficking. In this case, it's kind of screwed the good guys. Mm-hmm. But the Germans have directly given them some stuff, and I was watching them. They're using it quite effectively. Now they're able to destroy armored vehicles from as much as 3 or 4 miles away if they need to, whereas back in August, they really weren't even able to destroy armored vehicles at all.
Yeah. Well, so now, the article ends with you talking with this student, this Kurdish PhD student in the UK who I guess has suspended his education to come home to fight. And it sounds like they really need him. That's the way he puts it. The only reason I'm out here, Mitch, is because they need me out here, he says. But other than that, right, he doesn't know how to do anything than fire an AK.
Yeah, but he was hilarious and a really good guy. You know, what it comes down to is the Peshmerga, oftentimes it's referred to as a militia, but it's not quite right. It is a professional paid fighting force. But at the same time, guys, it'd be closer almost to a National Guard. So at the same time, with such a martial history of the Kurds, they've fought, you know, as a community for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So what ends up happening is a lot of guys just sort of show up, and they're needed, and they're put out on the line. They know how to operate, you know, maybe light weapons. And so they tend to run checkpoints and work as filler. You know, it's a small community, and they're engaged in a really nasty fight. So what he was saying basically was, you know, I'm here to defend my country. I'm no soldier. He was even asking me questions about the weapons the other guys were using. But, you know, he was one guy. There are a number, sure, of very professional Peshmerga, you know, guys who are pretty well trained and certainly very tough.
What kind of numbers, though?
They run in. There's a couple hundred thousand of them. You know, you have to remember, guys will rotate in and off the front. They often have jobs. I remember back in August, I was catching a taxi in Erbil and talking to the guy in my rudimentary Kurdish, and luckily he spoke Arabic. And, you know, he was like, oh, yeah, you've been out to the front lines. You know, I'm Peshmerga. And he's driving a taxi. You know, and he promptly told me, I ended up using it a little bit for a story, hating to be like Thomas Friedman. But, you know, I had a taxi driver laying out how this battle had gone down that he'd been in. And it was really interesting. And, you know, he'd said that he'd spent a couple weeks out on the front. And he comes back, drives a taxi, makes, you know, supplements his pretty meager income. I think the Pesher paid about $600 a month.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's an official fighting force made up of, you know, kind of like Minutemen, you know, guys that go on with their ordinary lives. And then, right, when they're needed, they grab their gun and they run out to the front line.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now Susanna George, I talked with her on the show, and she did this report, I guess, for the Global Post, if I'm remembering right, about a camp just on the outskirts of Mosul, she said, where there were a few hundred guys, and they were claiming about 6,000, I think, and talking real big about how, oh, yeah, here pretty soon, I guess maybe early this summer, we're marching on Mosul. We're going to rouse that Islamic State right out of there. And, you know, I wonder whether, you know, I mean, 200,000, that's pretty impressive, but is there anyone who can pay them enough or clap their hands loud enough or whatever to get these guys to line up and march on Mosul under American air cover and, you know, Special Forces Command and that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, you're talking about the Peshmerga. You know, these guys are here to defend Kurdistan. They don't really care about Mosul. I mean, it's a threat. You know, the fact that the Islamic State is, you know, they have the longest border, as they always point out. They've got, I think, close to 900 kilometers where they border the area controlled by the Islamic State. So they're fighting for their lives. But in their view, that's the Iraqi government's job, to retake the Arab city of Mosul. They defend their territory. So one of the things we're going to bump into is that, you know, you've got Iraq is so badly divided at this stage. It's barely an idea. Shia guys from Basra or Nasiriyah or even Baghdad, they'll fight to defend their homes from the Islamic State. But they don't care who controls Ramadi. Ramadi's a Sunni town that they never go to. Right. As far as they're concerned, you know, let ISIS have Ramadi. You start getting into a situation where you've got guys who basically don't want to die. So they'll die to defend their homes if they must. And certainly the Peshmerga have lost, I think, close to 800 people, maybe more since the fighting started in June. And they'll fight to the death to protect Erbil and Duhok and the Mosul Dam and strategic areas. But if you're asking, you know, 50,000 of those guys to go fight house to house in a city of 2 million Arabs, Sunni Arabs primarily, they're not really going to be that interested in doing it. That's the Iraqi government's job, and they're having a difficult time putting together a professional enough force to go do it. I was talking to Peshmerga officers yesterday, and I said, you know, the Iraqi government thinks they're going to be able to train up a force to go in and take care of Mosul by about April. What do you think? And they laughed me out of the room. They don't think there's any possible chance. One guy told me maybe in a year, But as he pointed out, the Americans trained this Arab Iraqi army for 10 years with billions of dollars, and they ran away. None of them wanted to die for Maliki in Mosul. Very few Sunni guys want to die for a Shiite government. And Shia guys don't want to die to liberate a Sunni city.
Yeah. Well, and this is, as you've been saying on the show for 7 months now or more, that's it. This is the final declaration of independence of Sunnistan, and Iraq is over. There ain't no putting this Humpty Dumpty back together again. You talk about how the Shia don't want Ramadi. That's what the Bada Brigade's been saying for 15 years now, man. No surprise. We'll be right back, y'all, with Mitchell Prothero in just one sec.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Mitchell Prothero. He's reporting on Iraq War 3 out of Erbil in Kurdistan. And I guess where we left off at the break was just the division here, how the Iraqi government, a.k.a. the Dawa Party and the Bada Brigade militia of the Supreme Islamic Council, these guys have no interest in ruling Sunnistan, as Mitch was saying. This is why Muqtada al-Sadr always denounced the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party back, say, 10 years ago for pushing the Iranian goals of splitting Iraq apart. And America accused Sadr of being the Iranian cat's paw, not the Iranian cat's paws that they were actually backing, and marginalized him and strengthened them. The same ones who then turned around and said, thanks a lot for giving us Baghdad, now get the hell out, and kicked America out and told the Sunnis, you guys are screwed. We don't care about you. We got the capital city, so rot in the sun, which is what led to them being so desperate that they would turn to create an alliance with Bakr Baghdadi and the Islamic State faction and got us into this mess in the first place. But then, so we're, I think, beating around the bush here. We're looking for an out. Mitch, how do we end this war, preferably with as little American involvement as possible? Or none,
well,
if you ask me.
You know, fixing this one's going to be tough. Already, I will say, I've been talking to Peshmerga commanders particularly a lot over the last week. I was in Kirkuk yesterday and went out to the Gwer front lines a couple of times the days before that. They say the airstrikes are having an effect. At this stage, you know, if, when they first started, they seemed so pinpoint. You know, you'd have four here, five there, hitting a truck, you know, a machine gun emplacement, things like that. It felt like it really wasn't getting much done. But fast forward a few months later, and what these guys are telling us is that to a certain extent, they are seeing this strategy of degrading the Islamic State's military capability working. They said that they're less dangerous now. They've lost a fair amount of equipment and men, that their morale isn't quite as good, and that they're not as capable of offensive operations. This is around Kurdistan, keep in mind. Over in Syria, I think it's a little bit less clear-cut. They're definitely losing ground in Kobani. The Kurds seem to have pretty much broken that siege and should be pretty set, you know, going forward. But you're still talking about tens of thousands of pretty well-trained men. From what we can tell, as many as 1,000 new volunteers a month are somehow still managing to get over the Turkish border and join them. So they are able to replenish at least the manpower, although maybe not the experience. So they're going to remain a formidable force. My feeling is, at least for Iraq, this doesn't end until the government comes up with a deal with the Sunnis, which the new prime minister does seem more inclined to do than Maliki. Even the Pesh actually had some fairly decent things to say about the guy in terms of aid and, you know, not stealing quite as much equipment that was meant to go to the Kurds and things like that. Mm-hmm. But until they reconcile with the tribes and then, you know, basically do this fairly bloody offensive that I can't imagine them being able to pull off this spring to actually retake control of the second largest city in the country, this is going to continue. Once they've managed to do that, once they've brought the Sunnis to the table, start working with the tribes, which is flat out just paying them off. But that's sort of how things politically work here. I guess it's how things politically work almost anywhere. And reestablish some semblance of central government control over the second largest city. At that stage, you can start treating the Islamic State, at least in Iraq, as more of an insurgency that you'll end up battling for another 10 years. But you can then say that you're the central government of Iraq. Mm. You know, until they can do that, this isn't a central government. This is a band of competing warlords and militias and, in a lot of cases, just outright thieves. Virtually, you know, I was watching them try to pass the Iraqi budget the other day down in Baghdad, you know, on TV, and I was just laughing because they're just going to steal it. You know, the services are not getting out to the people. Friends of mine I talk to who live in Baghdad say it's a complete mess. The entire neighborhoods are being taken over by militias. There's almost no sense of central government control. They've got to reverse that course before this you know, project can even be undertaken. And, you know, the new government's taken some steps, but it just doesn't look good.
Mm-hmm. Now, right there, you're referring to the militias taking over neighborhoods. You're saying they're finishing the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad that was halted at about 85% Shia back in 08, 09?
Yeah, I think they did. I mean, they pretty much cleaned it back then. I mean, there are still some Sunni neighborhoods of Baghdad, and I don't have widespread reports of, like, you know, total massacres or anything like that. But certainly, you know, people have started disappearing again. But in terms of protecting neighborhoods, you've seen a lot of Shia, you know, and I don't work that much in Baghdad, so, you know, there's other guys you should talk to about it. But, you know, definitely there's a sense that the areas that go under the control of these militias are being run by the militia leaders. They're not being run necessarily by the central government. So just the other day, the commander for the Iraqi government troops in Samarra was killed, I think about 10 days ago. He was an Iranian Revolutionary Guard officer. Mm-hmm. Like, he was an Iranian guy, and he was in charge of the defense of Samarra. I don't say that Iran has overtly huge numbers of troops here, but they've got officers and advisors all throughout the command and control of these militias. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's hypocritical because, you know, the U.S. is basically trying to do the same thing in three locations where they're trying to train up brigades to retake Anbar and Mosul. But these guys are actually out on the ground getting their hands dirty, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, too. You have all of Anbar province and I guess I forget now when we last talked whether Bakuba is now under the control of the Islamic State or not, but it's pretty much all of the west and northwest of the country at this point. So it's not just Mosul they'd have to sack these guys from, and they could just as easy move to Fallujah and say Fallujah's their capital if America goes to Mosul, right?
Right. Well, they say at this stage they say Raqqa's their capital.
Oh, right, right. Yeah.
In Syria, because remember, they don't recognize the border. It's all one country to them. But, you know, this is often missed. Yeah, the fall of Mosul in mid-June was a huge deal, and it really brought everybody's attention, including mine. To be honest, I've been completely focusing on Syria for a year and just occasionally reading up reports thinking, wow, Iraq doesn't look like it's going all that well, but I had massacres every day in Syria to handle. But if you remember about a year ago, most of Anbar fell to the tribes and to the Islamic State. This started 6 months before most of us remember.
Right.
You know, and so at this stage, the Iraqi central government, they do control a few large bases, partially one where the Americans are helping to train them. They've still got some control over government centers in Ramadi, but Fallujah is completely gone. A bunch of different towns, you know, you might as well say, for the most part, Anbar is completely controlled by the Islamic State.
Yeah.
So, yeah, dealing with that is going to be something that you're going to have to deal with just like you will with Mosul.
Yeah. Hey, but speaking of which, when you talk about the Islamic State hoisting the flag up over Fallujah a year ago, 6 months before the actual declaration of the caliphate and the fall of Mosul, the way I remember it, too, was the tribe said, hey, take that flag down, and they did. And they bided their time, and that brings us back to that question of the relative power between the Sunni tribes and the Islamic State, which is, you know, after all, not the way things are usually done around there, hasn't been. But so the question is to me then, if I can oversimplify, it seems to me, Mitch, like it was pretty damn easy for the tribes to turn on Al-Qaeda in Iraq and say, thanks, but no thanks for your help anymore, guys. You're too big for your britches and we're done with you, back in 2006 and 2007. Obviously, it helped that Petraeus was giving them guns and money, but they were already doing it throughout 06 before they ever struck their deal with Petraeus. But so the question is now, and I know I've asked you this before, but things have changed over the last 6 months too. I wonder how much harder or how much easier you think it'd be for the tribes to do that same kind of thing. And in fact, take for granted for the sake of argument that they have open access to the U.S. Treasury to pay these guys off the same way if a body will stand in the role of Petraeus here and pay these guys to try to do awakening too.
It'll be harder, but it can be done. At the end of the day, the Sunni tribes run Anbar. They run Saladin province, and Islamic State couldn't have come in without them, and they can throw them back out. And it will be about money, but that's the money's not the hard part right now. The hard part is the reconciliation politically and building trust. I know I hate to sound like an NGO expert, but you need to have a trust building exercise. Maybe we can send them all on Outward Bound, where, you know, the Shia government and these Sunni guys need to quit seeing each other as flat out enemies. Because they are going to have to live together. Even under a partition system, it's going to require cooperation. At this stage, both hate and distrust each other so much that simply the Americans won't allow, I mean, the central government won't allow a huge transfer of money and weapons to the Sunni tribes because they think it'll turn on Baghdad.
Yeah. Well, I guess the next question we don't have time for then would be, and barring that, and taking for granted Sunni independence, what can be done to bring peace? But that'll have to wait for next time. Thanks. It's Mitch Prothero, McClatchyDC.com. Appreciate it.
No problem. Always a pleasure.